Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and we're here for our monthly office hours for the Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology. And this month, we're focusing on the blood sugar balancing and IRSPT issues. So we have invited everybody from the IRSPT program to join us for this, and I'm excited to have you here. And I'm excited to hear some feedback as to how things are going, not just with you going through the program and learning and hopefully applying this stuff to yourself, but also with how it's going with your client. And I'm hoping that everybody took advantage of the opportunity to take somebody through it, whether officially through the Before Be Gone program with me or on your own as you followed along. Either way, I think that you're going to get the most experience and you're going to really learn this stuff the best by doing it. So like everything else in life, right, you got to do it to learn it. So I would love to hear from a little bit of feedback from you guys. But before we do that, I am just going to go and move something over so I can access my tea. And give me 1 second. Okay. All right. So I've got that set up, and so what I want to do is let you know we've got all of the modules are out there except for the last one, which is taking the show on the road, taking it out to the community. And the plan for that is to have that ready and out by next week. The material is all presented and put together. There's just a few video editings and things like that that need to be done. And the focus of that module is to really show you how to take what you've learned here and put it together in a little program that you can take out on the road. And what we've offered to you as a bonus for this program is a done-for-you protocol. Basically, a PowerPoint that I put together that we're not just giving you a PDF, we're actually giving you the PowerPoint slides and giving you the permission to just take it and do as you will. You can just, you don't need to copyright it. You don't need to give me credit unless you want to, although it's always nice to do that. You just take it on the road, use my slides, edit them, put your copyright in there, use different ones, use some of mine, some of your own, but it's a starting point. You've also got a transcript, so you can go through it and see how I present the information to in a public setting about blood sugar and take and choose and shorten it or lengthen it depending on how much time you actually have to go out there and do it. When we go through the module, and I'll talk to you about some of the ways that we can help you or how you can organize it. You can either do a little short presentation at, say, a health fair where you're doing like a half an hour presentation, or you could actually go out and schedule your own presentation and make it like a two-hour free evening on how to get your blood sugar in balance so you can overcome belly fat, or how to get your, you know, prevent diabetes, or any number of topics, whatever your target audience is looking for, and it can be really, really valuable. And then you'll see at the end how I make an offer for my Before Be Gone program, and I'll teach you ways that you can make an offer at the end of those and have people, you can invite them to come for a private consultation if you're doing one-on-one work. If you are doing a small group or trying to get a small local group started, you can invite them until you only have a certain number of seats. However you're planning to do it, you can do that. And we're going to help you do that in the next module. So what I would like to do is see, I would like to take at least two of you to just tell me where you're at, give me feedback, how you're doing with your own blood sugar balancing, if that's been an issue for you, and how you're using this with your clients, whether it be in a formal program or just incorporating it into what you're already doing. So raise your hand, star 2, and I will call on you, and you can share. If you're just listening in on the web, then go ahead and type it into the Q&A box or the chat. I'm opening up the chat as well. We don't always just rely on the chat because sometimes the chat just decides to go away. It's kind of what they consider a beta feature, not a full feature, not a guaranteed feature. So sometimes it just like dies in the middle. So we still use the Q&A. I like the two-way chat because it's great because we can communicate with each other. The other one is just a one-way and it's much more reliable. So let's see. We have two people that raised their hands. Great. We have Cassandra and Maria. Maria's first. So let's go ahead and do Maria and then Cassandra. Hello.
Hello there. How are you?
I am excellent. How about you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Wonderful. I really appreciated what you posted, what you sent to me, that little example of the schedule that you put together. It was really, really clear and it looked very good.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was hoping that you give me the thumbs up.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of takes some time to put it together.
No kidding.
But once you accomplish, it's kind of really good, you know, because you really reinforce what you've learned and make it very clear, because before I was kind of telling my clients, you know, what to do and having them to make notes, which is kind of help as well for them to make notes. But, you know, I wasn't trusting that they were, you know, going back to it. So I said, you know what, they've done a piece of it, so let me help now, and then they can carry that with them whenever they go. And that's what I suggested, to print a few copies and have it, so to reinforce. So I think it was good to get it done, so I appreciate your time to review it.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I love it.
So regarding myself, you know, I've been following, I've been doing the B4 Vegan too, not, you know, not as much on the juicing side, but I'm doing on the food, which is not too different than what I eat generally. But I haven't got my blood sugar above 100 yet, so I'm very, very happy about that.
Nice.
I'm good with that. But one thing that I've been really focusing, which has been a struggle of mine for the longest time, and last year I made it a point to improve, is my sleep.
Yeah.
So I said, you know what? I'm gonna try to go to bed by midnight. You know, by 11, maybe in a few months, but by midnight. And I can tell a difference. I can definitely tell a difference, you know, and I'm kind of, you know, that I work from home now and I'm focused on this, so I don't have to get out of the house, you know, unless I want to. I've been sleeping without the alarm, and my sleeping is really routine with about 7 hours and a half.
Nice.
And I knew that before, because I had done a testing last year. You know, I said, how many hours do I need? So I slept 3 hours with no alarm, and the average came 7.5. And, you know, it's been consistent that way.
Great.
But the other thing that I notice is when I wake up, I do the melatonin kind of testing that you suggested, which is go either outside or look from my window straight into a bright part of the sky.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. First, you do feel like you wake up. And the second is, it gets to about 11 o'clock at night, 11:30. I'm getting sleepy.
There you go. Your melatonin's kicking in.
This is amazing. Amazing. And I'm like, this is unreal. It doesn't matter, you know, if I had coffee before or not. I'm not stopping the coffee, you know, during the program. It doesn't do much to me, coffee. I like the taste. I don't put anything on it. It's black, but I don't drink a ton anyway, you know. Even if I have at night, you know, and before 11 o'clock, like the other day I was at Starbucks at 10 o'clock, you know, I was sipping very little. And it's about 11 o'clock. Here you go. The clock goes. And so this has been a great experiment on that, and I hope I will continue to improve and, you know, to stick not beyond midnight and lower into maybe 11 o'clock or something. If one day I can do that.
It would be awesome. I know you and I share that issue of not getting to bed on time, and not many people would say, yeah, I'm going to bed early. I'm going to bed at midnight. But I totally relate to that, because that's me. But I will invite you, if you haven't already done so, to listen to Dr. Christine Horner, the interview I did with her yesterday, because we got into the sleep, and she really created a very compelling argument for getting to bed by 10 o'clock. And I'm like, she was saying, yeah, the easy part, get people to sleep on time. Easy? I can eat cardboard before I can go to bed early. Like, that's not easy for me and for other people.
Yeah.
So she gave some very compelling reasons why, related to breast health, related to cancer in general, and it made a lot of sense. So you might want to just pop in and listen to that. And she recommended, like I've done this too, I usually recommend decreasing by 15 minutes every day. She said once a week you just decrease it. So you just go 15 minutes earlier every week, so it becomes habit for a whole week, and then you go to the next week, and that way you create something that's a lasting habit rather than something you just do for 3 or 4 days and then you quit on.
Yeah, okay, yeah, because for me I operate primarily on knowledge kind of thing. You know, once I believe and I understand,
right,
then that's when I start turning the clock and I said, okay, this is something I got to pay attention to.
Right,
so,
and that's,
yeah,
that's why I want you to listen to it, because it really struck me, because up till now, nobody's really been able to explain it in such a way that it mattered to me very much.
Yeah, no, I'll definitely do that. Thank you. So on my client side, I think she's been able to manage. So what I'm doing with her is this, you know, she either comes to the Wednesday to participate or she's listening in. I give her, because of her work schedule and all that, she's easily overwhelmed. So I kind of guide her through what to read, you know, to prioritize for her. So besides the, you know, the time that she spends looking and reading the material that you provide or that I kind of guide her through, I spend normally about an hour and a half with her on a weekly basis, you know, on Sundays normally saying, okay, let's review what we've done, you know, how you're doing, improvements, and what needs to be done in the next week. So that I'm doing that on the side, and she feels, I think, that helps, you know, her. I think that personal touch.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's always going to be better with personal touch, you know, with
right.
your group, so that it could be cost effective for people and getting the education there. But, you know, when it comes down to it, people do best when you can personalize it for them.
Right. And and this person is kind of long distance, so I cannot see her, you know.
Right.
So it's always, it's kind of by phone thing. But she has, you know, struggles with the, I made this bad thing for her a priority. You know, she's doing good with the foods. You know, she went over about 110 a couple of times because she didn't test the food that she shipped before, and all of a sudden the beets kind of got her up, and I said, well, you know, sometimes people, you know, you cannot hold their hands too much, but it feels like you have to.
But it feels like sometimes you have to, because people will ask about things that you've already told them.
I know.
And you have to just bite your tongue in terms of saying, but I already told you that, just read it, or it's right there. And just go, oh, yeah, okay, because it's being kind and gentle. And know that they're overwhelmed and know that they've got a lot going on. And there's a lot of material, and it's new for them. It's not as new for us. You know, if you're going through this stuff is not as new for you. But think about it from their perspective. It could be overwhelming. Even as much as I tell people, take it at your own pace, as much as I say, just do the short list. Don't worry about everything if you don't need to understand it. But a lot of folks are like you and I, where once we understand the why, we're going to do it. And that's why I make sure that I provide a lot of that. But for some people, it's just, tell me what to do and I'll do it.
I know. But, you know, in my opinion, those are the people that end up going and making very similar mistakes.
Exactly. I agree.
Because they don't get it. They don't understand why. But, you know, people are different, and I don't know. So, anyway, so she's doing good with the food. She's struggling with the sleep. I'm really trying to help her on improving that, and I explain why, you know, and hopefully this will help. The blood sugar, you know, measuring, it's reasonably okay. She's doing good, though. I cannot complain too much. There's others. The burst is where she's kind of struggling, you know, to get the time to do it. And to get also to do the 10, 15 minute breaks, you know, for exercise. That's the challenge. But we keep talking her into it, and hopefully she will build a good behavior going forward. She needs it. I mean, but she has mentioned that, you know, her confidence has improved. Brain fog is less, you know, she can concentrate a little better, and she doesn't feel that sense of overwhelm kind of thing. You know, the anxiety is not an overwhelming feeling.
Right, so she's able to manage it better because her brain isn't so irritated, right?
With all exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's what I can tell about myself and about my client right now. So it's doing good. I'm excited for next week's module because I think really what we're discussing here is so critical for about, you know, 60% of the population.
Oh, I know.
More.
I know.
And
learning
it
to phrase it in a way that people are going to hear. Like, when you go out and you say, I'm going to do a class on blood sugar balancing, you're going to get the people who already know that they've been told that they're either pre-diabetic or hypoglycemic, or they just kind of feel that they have blood sugar imbalances. And that's only going to be a small percentage. When you can, like, why the way I lead with B4 Be Gone is who doesn't have belly fat, brain fog, and burnout, or one or all three of those, right?
Right.
So you figure out what it is that you want to lead with. You know, you can lead with just the belly fat, and then you'll get a lot of people who are overweight and want to get rid of that. Because we get a lot of people who don't have the belly fat that are underweight, and let me tell you, they're more challenging than the overweight ones because you can't figure out what to feed them.
Right. You know, the other thing is, you know, the more I think about it, you know, I'm new to, you know, to this career here, but, you know, it seems to me, it's not like it's all, you know, involving, you know, blood sugar, but in certain ways it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the things that we're learning how to implement, how to manage, it will impact the lifestyle. So although I provide, you know, whatever is weight loss or other things, you know, I have a potential client here asking about a 90-day lifestyle program that I have. And I'm like, well, I was doing certain things like this before, but not to the extent. But for me, it's like, okay, there is no other way to really improve somebody's lifestyle unless I address, you know, the sleep, the stress, and all these things that we're talking, which before for me was more superficial. It was more nutrition-based. Now, for me, is the only thing I see is I have to include those things in any program that I offer. I don't know if that sounds crazy, but...
No, it's not crazy at all. And, in fact, you know, I used to just really focus much more on the nutrition and the other stuff where, yeah, you do it, until I started to see the impact of just one of those being off, with seeing people with this perfect diet, but their stress levels up the wazoo and they're not sleeping or they're not moving. And it really does have to be all of them. Personally, for me, I didn't have brain fog, belly fat, or burnout, but I found that I had blood sugar imbalances going like crazy. Now, most people would say, well, why did you bother even addressing it? And probably if I hadn't been teaching the class, I wouldn't have even tested my own blood sugar because I didn't have symptoms. Yet when I found it, and then the research that I'm showing, you know, where every time it goes above 120, you're getting some peripheral nerve damage. Every time it goes above 140, you're getting some retinal damage. Every time it goes above 100 even, there's a little bit of arterial stiffening. Or every time the insulin goes up, you're getting that stiffening. And I look at my family and say, there's no old people. And, you know, my mom was dead by the time she was my age of a sudden heart attack after looking like she was healthy before that. Maybe, so that's another avenue for explaining to people, is like,
right.
I think everybody should test their blood sugar. And I speak to a lot of colleagues and all that don't do it. And then after I give my spiel, and they're looking at me going, everybody needs to test their blood sugar. Everybody needs to test it. I say, absolutely, I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah.
And I cannot wait until the non-invasive blood sugar testing comes out. They're looking at things like that you put some kind of thing into the tears and you test it that way. They're looking at a topical thing. There's a lot of things in the research stage right now that my guess is that within a year or two, we're going to have the non-invasive. So the people who don't want the little holes in their fingers, right, they're afraid of pricking their fingers, it's going to be easy. And everybody can do it. And my goal is to educate practitioners so everybody knows that this is a critical piece of a client intake, a patient intake, a part of their exam, just like, you know, how much do they weigh and what's their blood pressure, what is their glucose curve, not what's their fasting glucose, but what does their curve look like, not what it is 2 hours after eating, which is what diabetics are told. Test your blood sugar before when you're fasting and then test it 2 hours after the meal. And if it's down to 140, you're in good shape. And I'm cringing going down to 140. I'm just envisioning all the retinal damage and the peripheral nerve damage that's happening. And even the islet cells, there's some studies that show that even when it's over 100, that there's some damage happening to the islet cells. So no wonder some of these type 2 diabetics end up becoming, you know, functionally type 1 diabetic, and they're not making insulin anymore because their islet cells are being damaged by the high levels of glucose. So it is, you're right, it is a serious problem, and you're not crazy to think that you have to do all these pieces, because all these pieces matter. And, you know, I remember, you know, you've probably seen some of my blog posts. One of my blog posts was, I ate a candy bar today. I was to get attention, because people know I'm totally opposed to sugar and I haven't eaten sugar in 30 years. So I ate a candy bar today, got a lot of attention, got a lot out of opens, and I started with, well, I didn't really eat the candy bar, but I might as well have, because my blood sugar shot up as if I did, because I didn't do my heart math. I lost control. I started getting really upset, and my blood sugar shot up.
Right.
And people need to know that when they're sitting there worrying about the finances or fretting about the fact that they dropped a glass of water and now they have to clean it or any of the silly things that sometimes people fret about, that every time they do that, it's like they ate a candy bar without the pleasure of eating the candy bar.
I hear you.
Yeah. So I think it's great that you're going to incorporate this into your program. So for everybody, you know, if you've already got programs, what of what we've learned here can you just fit into your program? How can you incorporate talking about blood sugar into every strategy session or intake or discovery session or whatever you call that first visit with people?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's critical.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good. Well, thank you very much for all you do. I've learned a ton, and I really enjoy the essential oils. That's something that I've been ignoring, you know, for a while, but I think that I should not. I think that, you know, clearly has a lot of good stuff in there that it's one more tool in the toolbox, I guess.
Exactly.
So anyway, I appreciate all the work and attention you give us. It's very helpful.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Cassandra. Hello, Cassandra.
Hello, Dr. Rita Marie. How are you?
I'm good today. How are you?
Good, good. So let's see. So myself, because, you know, I've taken this before with you last year, and at that time I realized, like, again, I was one of those people who, you know, no history of diabetes in my family or anything like that. And when I got my A1C taken last year, I was surprised because it represented insulin resistance. And so at that time I was following and stuff, got a little bit off, and then I would say earlier this year started taking it and stuff. And so what I noticed is when I wake up in the morning, because I'm very consistent when I wake up in the morning to see what it is, and if my problem is eating late because I go to bed late. I'm one of them, along with you, Marie, the sleeping. And when I do that, it's like 96, 100, maybe 102.
Yeah.
But if I do not eat, and my, like, it's really, I need to stop eating at like 7 or 8, because if I stop eating then, my blood sugar is like 70 or 80 in the morning.
In the morning, nice. Yeah, that makes a difference.
I mean, even if I, because sometimes I'll be like, okay, I'll just eat at 10 and I'll stay up.
Yeah, I do that too. I do that, John. It isn't good.
I gotta stay up because I need 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, good. That gives me a license to do all work. Good. I have to stay up. Oh, God.
And then, but you know what? It doesn't make a difference because even when I do that, then my blood sugar is so high because now I've affected my, even if I have that 4 hours, it's interesting, even if I have that 4 hours in between, if it's late, if I'm eating late, but it's probably if I'm staying up late, you know, if I'm staying up over that 11 o'clock time. So, yeah, so that's been a challenge for me, and it's just because of my schedule. And so I've been trying to plan where, okay, take a meal and eat before leaving my office. Because sometimes
good idea.
I keep clients, up to 8 or something. But my husband, too, he eats late. He eats late, so it's just like if I come home and I smell food.
I'll start my thing tomorrow, right? I'll start eating earlier tomorrow. But today you made such a good meal, I'm going to do it, right?
Exactly. And every time. And then when I wake up in the morning, I'm like, look what you're doing to yourself. Like,
yeah.
The evidence is here every single time. It's like, I never eat late or, you know, my blood sugar is, you know, under 100, you know, even under 90, you know, it never happens. So, being more consistent with that,
what's that going to take though, Cassandra? What do you need? What kind of support, what kind of accountability, how do you talk to yourself to get yourself committed? Now, because I want this to be really clear, because this is the stuff you're going to deal with your clients. It's not even
right.
So much the what they need to do, but it's to motivate and inspire them to go past those, whatever it is, the rationale, the excuses, the I'll just start tomorrow.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think I'm gonna have to marinate because I really don't know, because I try different things, like you're saying. Sometimes I'll be consistent and I'll bring it and everything, and so yeah, I'll have to marinate on that to see really honestly what can I, you know, what is actually going to work, because the different things that I have. You know, talking to myself, you know, having, you know, bringing the, you know, a delicious meal to work and, you know, or to my office and stuff like that. And I'm almost thinking, and this could be it too, is the challenge of still working nights. So I'm all off balance, but it's funny. There, I have been more committed to eat before because I'm working 7 p.m. to 7:30 a.m. in the morning.
So how many days a week do you do that?
Three. So
three days
every
a week.
Saturday,
okay.
Sunday,
that's why
Monday.
We're having so much trouble. Yeah, your body clock is not working with you.
Oh, absolutely. But now what I've done, and I have been committed, is not eating, because sometimes I would eat a snack at, like, right before leaving work at, like, 6. Like, I usually would eat an apple with almond butter or something. And then I would go home and sleep. And if I wake up, when I wake up and check my blood sugar, it's, you know, high, you know, 100. And
yeah, because you ate right before going to bed. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Yeah, so the same rules apply, Cassandra, whether you're working nights or days, is the 3 hours before sleeping, or in your case, it sounds more like 4. You still have to apply that same rationale. So if you're going to eat an apple with almond butter, you know, make it be at 3 in the morning when you're still on your shift, if you can.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, yes. I have been pushing it up because I used to eat, like, at midnight, like a main meal at midnight and then a snack later on. Well, now I eat my main meal at, like, 10. And then a snack like at 1 or 2, and that has helped, and I seem to be getting into the rhythm of that. Like, I'm okay with that, because I actually, when I come home, I sleep better if I haven't eaten.
Oh yeah,
late.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So I think once I get that rhythm and then get the other rhythm in, like that consistency of that, will help, yeah. So, yeah.
And the other thing, too, Cassandra, and this is something when we're working with our clients is really important to just really hone in on why it's important. If you really haven't really bought why it's so important to keep that blood sugar steady, what is the downside of your blood sugar being in the 90s? Like, really look at some of the research that I've given you about, you know, when it goes in the 90s, the higher, like, very, like, double or triple the risk of cardiac incidences in people with their fasting blood sugars over 90 versus less than 90. And, like, what is it so, because for you, you have a mission, right? You're out there, you want to help a lot of people. You want to change the world, so to speak, of healthcare, because that's why you're in healthcare. And
right.
You need to be the shining example, and you need to have your own health completely in order to do that most effectively. So it's,
right.
I think some of it is tuning into that, and I don't know how many of you have done this visually, but I know I've asked you to, like, do your goals and your vision and do that. But what if you did, like, a visual of that? Like, for me, I just have in my mind this visual of this woman that's, like, she's clearly in her late 80s or early 90s because of her wrinkles. You could just tell in her hair. But she's on the balance beam, like holding yourself up into this position. And I say, that's what I'm striving for, is to still at that age have the strength and the stamina and the endurance to be pursuing a dream like that, like a beautiful thing, and to have the strength to do it, whereas, you know, most of our friends are probably going around with walkers.
Right, right. And that, yeah, so that makes, yeah, I like that, because when I do, and that does motivate me, that does motivate it when I'm thinking I need to be the example. It's helped me, like, get more into a routine of exercise lately, because I'm like, I need to be doing this. How can I be telling my clients, you know, yes, I thing I can do, I have that down, but every, you know, these other things. And and that's funny that you said the lady, because I always visualize myself. I'm like, I'm going to live to over 100, and 100, I'm going to be on Time Magazine doing a split with peace signs in my hands in the air.
There you go. That would be the great visual for you.
Right. Right. So, yes.
Take that and put it on an index card. Print it out. Print out a picture of somebody doing a split. Put your face on it.
Right.
And then just live to that. Because when you get tempted to go, oh, that food my husband made smells so good, you're looking at it going, I don't need it.
Right, right. Yes, that's helpful. That is very helpful. Thank you. Yeah, because that does help. And so client-wise, okay, so I had my mother, I gifted her for the Before Be Gone, and I really haven't, I checked in with her, and she's like, yeah, I got the emails. I'm like, have you listened to anything? Have you, and then I haven't followed up with her, so, but I have had someone, a client, who I, as part of the protocol, had her purchase a glucometer, and she was taking her blood glucose, and it was amazing, because now I looked at labs, and her labs, her A1C was high, and that's why we did the, you know, the blood sugar type protocol, and I mean, her blood sugar is like great. It's better than mine. I mean, she rarely goes over 120, and that's eating like, you know, I'm like, well, test some other foods, because I'm just like amazed. Like, it stays at 80 or 90. She goes to sleep by 10 o'clock. She does have some stress. But what's interesting with her, and, you know, I'll just briefly say it on this call, but it probably would be for any PT call, is because now she's released some weight, you know, like probably 18 pounds since she's been working with me. She's been working with me for like 5 months. But she's pretty heavy, so she still has some weight on her. And I'm like, you know, trying to dig deeper on that. And we did, digestion, and we did blood sugar. And now I've asked her to go redo her labs, get her labs, because I want to, you know, examine like her, see what her A1C is now, see what her, you know, thyroid, and I'm almost thinking she might have sluggish liver, and I'd like to have to do that. But,
yeah, liver and adrenal. You want to look at her adrenal.
Right.
Cortisol, you know, and especially if the A1C hasn't come down in spite of the fact that her blood, that her glucose has come down, then you want to really look at the adrenal. And if you've looked at the digestion, you know, some of the things that prevent people from losing weight are their gut flora. So if she's got the formiculites and the bacteroides out of balance, then she's going to be more leaning towards the weight gain. And then, you know, shifting her and making sure she's doing the probiotics and all those sorts of things would be helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she's doing probiotics. She's doing, she was doing, when we were doing the blood sugar, she was doing the chromium, the magnesium, the vitamin C, and she was really good. She was keeping with it and everything, and
You're saying it in the past. Is she still staying on those things?
She's still doing the probiotics. She stopped the chromium. I stopped her on the chromium just because, like, her blood sugars were just so, I mean, they would hardly go over 100.
Okay, so I want you to go back, and I want you to read the section of the latest module, the implementation module, where we talk about how do you know when they can start weaning off of their supplements, and the key word is weaning off.
Okay.
Okay? And
okay.
you do it gradually and slowly because you don't want them to backtrack.
Okay. All right.
Okay?
Yeah. And
I would get the A1C again because you might be surprised that
right.
you're seeing things, but that there are some spikes and that, you know, could be related to stress or some other things going on. So, yeah, I would, if somebody says to me, oh, yeah, they used to have their blood sugars high and now their blood sugars are getting down to, you know, in the 60s after they take their chromium, then I'm like, oh, maybe they're taking too much. But mostly you don't take too much chromium. It just gets stored. It's stored in the liver.
Okay, yeah. All right, so, yeah, I will do that because I have. She's supposed to, I've assigned that to her some time back to say I need a new, some new labs.
Yeah.
I need
yeah.
new labs because something's going on here. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if you're really, you know, recording all your foods that you're, you know, like eating or something. Because I'm like, something's blocking, you know.
Right.
So, okay.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I would look at, you know, I would look at the gut flora as well and the
okay.
adrenals. Those are the things I would look at.
Okay. Great. Okay.
Right.
Well, thank you so much. And I'll go and I'll look at that implementation. You know,
yeah, look at that. I get into a lot
yeah.
of detail on it. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, great. And that it was very helpful, too, hearing, like, what I need to do. So thank you.
Okay. We have to be our own best patients, don't we? Thank you, Cassandra. All right. Does anybody else have any questions, comments, client stories, cases that you want to discuss, go ahead and do a star two. And I see Beverly's on. Hi, Beverly. You haven't been on in a while. And Laura, I think it's the first time back since your surgery, so welcome. Yay. I'm going to look at the Q&A in the chat and see if we have any questions. And I'm also going to look at the site. So for people who couldn't have made it here live to see what's going on with that. Oops, that's not what I wanted. Yeah, so we have a few here, the last call like this. Yeah, we have a few of these here. Marie is asking, this was, I think we might have handled this before, but I'll check it out anyway. What methods or metrics do you recommend using to determine the best diet for someone, that is higher low carb or less or low protein? You know, a lot of it is the blood sugar. A lot of it is trial and error, like starting somebody on a moderate type of approach. I mean, I always check people's blood sugar, and if they have problems, we'll work with the carbs. But some people need to, it's fat. You know, some people have insulin resistance because they've been eating too many processed fats and it's not so much the carbs. So there's a lot of testing, and we go into a lot more detail on that in the NEPT program with looking at the various systems and looking at how their digestion's working and all that sort of stuff. Will reading in bed interfere with sleep patterns during the night? That's a great question. Or does it depend on the subject of the book, mentally engaging or not? Yeah, I think that it's really not a good idea to do really challenging reading right before going to bed, like, you know, if you're studying for a physics test, for example, versus reading a romance novel, versus reading some kind of self-help, kind of visualization, meditation type book. It also depends on the lighting. If you've got the lights turned up really bright, overhead lights, et cetera, versus an incandescent, you know, just one little light bulb, or even better would be reading in the dark with one of those reading lights over the book. And it also depends on whether it's a book or a Kindle kind of iPad thing that you're reading on. So more and more people are reading on devices, and when you're sitting there with that device close to your head and reading things in, the melatonin, the pineal gland's being stimulated by that light and is turning down on the melatonin. So I think it depends what they're reading. You're totally right, but it also depends on the lighting and the media. And wonder if it's like wine, many read to fall asleep. Yeah, so I think that's true because you don't get as much melatonin, or if you've engaged your mind mentally too much. I always recommend listening. Like, even if you get a book on tape, if you want to listen to it, as long as it's not heavy duty. If it's heavy duty, it'll put you to sleep, so that's no big deal. So I would more recommend doing a book on tape and listening to that before going to bed than the actual reading. Okay, Maria wants to know, I don't get it well, the difference between glucose clearance and glucose tolerance, especially when either is depressed or decreased. Could you walk me through? That's great. So clearance is how rapidly you're going to lower the glucose, and that depends on a couple of factors. It depends on how much insulin you produce, and it depends on how rapidly that glucose is going up. So when it's going up really quickly, your body may not be able to respond. And it depends on the state of the receptors and whether they're able to open up and let the glucose into the cells. That's what glucose clearance is. Glucose tolerance, it's not really that much different. I think about glucose tolerance is about how much glucose can you take. What's your threshold of glucose that you can take in at any one point in time before you exceed your body's ability to clear it? So that's how I think about the two. So the tolerance is like, say, you know, I can eat half a cup of blueberries. I can't eat more than a half a cup of blueberries, or my body can't clear it fast enough to keep my blood sugar steady. Maria, you have a lot of questions. Let's see. Yeah, very good. Do you have Cyrex Labs 3 or 4 would be useful for psoriasis? So as a refresher, Cyrex Array 3 is the whole gluten sensitivity. So it's the gluteomorphines, the caseomorphines, and all the different subfractions of gluten. So it's about 20 different subfractions of gluten. And number 4 is cross-reactivity. So in a sense, a lot of psoriasis comes from gut problems, so leaky gut and irritation to the gut, and it also comes from allergic responses. Well, if you've got gluten intolerance and you're eating cross-reactive foods, that's going to contribute to both of those things. It's going to contribute to the leaky gut not getting healed, and it's contributing to an allergic immune response. So I think that, yeah, they could be very good at identifying what is actually causing that. A lot of people won't do a gluten-free diet unless they see the tests. And a lot of people don't want to look at that list of cross-reactives and just avoid all of them, because some of them may be so, you know, just perfect. So it could be helpful. A friend of mine has been doing strict autoimmune paleo diet, no improvements. Should she try low FODMAP diet? However, she's frustrated with it and about to give up the whole thing. My understanding is that it could easily take more than 1 hour for results. More than 1 hour, of course. So, it might take more than a year. Yeah, so I would say there are definitely things on the cross-reactivity panel. I would say that's the more, because if she's doing autoimmune paleo, she's not doing gluten. She's really not doing grains. But some of the other things on the cross-reactivity test are things like sesame seed and hemp seed and teff and a few other things. So what I would do is look at the cross-reactivity test to start. Look at that list and see if she's willing to just stop everything on that list. But it's going to take a couple of months. You also want to look at her gut. So is she having gas and bloating? And has she done a leaky gut repair protocol? A low FODMAP diet is a pain to do because it's not even more restrictive than, say, an autoimmune paleo diet, but it certainly is something she could give a try for a couple of weeks. Clearly, if she still has the psoriasis, it says to me that her immune system is overly activated and she's got some sort of digestive thing. So really just going through the whole gut protocol and clearing up her gut and getting rid of all the allergens and doing a food elimination. Personally, I mean, sometimes if I just am finding that somebody is not getting the results with eliminations, I'll just put them on a fast if they'll do it for like a 4 days or what I call a rare foods diet, where they just eat the things that they normally don't eat and see. And sometimes it's not a food sensitivity slash allergy per se. It may be an intolerance for a particular class category of macronutrients like the FODMAP thing does. Well, if she hasn't checked vitamin D, and she absolutely has to. So, you know, I'm assuming as you give me information that there's whole protocols that we take people through, and I teach them in my NEPT training. I mean, we have like a 12-hour module on the history and physical exam stuff to go through. And vitamin D is critical for anybody that has any kind of autoimmune condition, and psoriasis is. So vitamin D levels need to be maintained in the 80 to 100 range, in my opinion, in an autoimmune condition. And DHA and also EPA levels need to be maximized. So in this particular case, two tests that I would recommend would be vitamin D and a blood spot fatty acid to see what her fatty acid levels are, because those fatty acid levels have to be optimal. Maria, during the food reintroduction, how long do you suggest they wait to introduce the next foods? Yes, I explain it in the module, but I say 4 days. Absolutely 4 days. I mean, 3 days is minimum, but 4 days would be great. She ate dairy for 3 days straight and wait 2 days to introduce. Oh, I see what you mean. So after she's stopped eating it. If you introduce a food and it goes 4 days, 3 to 4 days that they take it, and they don't have an adverse reaction that you can tell, then you can add the next food the next day. But if they have an adverse reaction, I would wait 2 to 4 days until that adverse reaction calms down so you'll be able to tell. Good questions. I'm going to check one more place, which is the INE page. INE office hours. Okay. Nope, we don't have anything there. All right, so now I'm going to come back. I'm going to look for more hands, but I'm also looking for questions that have been typed in. Byrie, I love it that you've been coming to all these calls, and I know you're working and can't always go out and participate as much as you want, but this is cool. Byrie said, thank you. I was on the Vital Call and radio program. I heard Christine Horner mention some statistics that say coffee can be helpful and heard her say 4 or 5 cups of coffee a day. I heard you start to diplomatically say yes, however, about what about the downsides, but I missed the rest. It was late at night. I had my laptop. Question, do you have any suggestion for clients who say they have red coffee can protect against cancer? Yeah, so she actually went into the fact that if somebody's got burned out adrenals, or they're trying to rebuild their adrenals, that the coffee can continue to be a problem. I find that when I'm working with somebody with burned out adrenals and they're on a lot of coffee, I never just take them off the coffee. We work at building things up and so that they can make energy on their own and then gradually build it down. She said that there was some stuff that showed that the equivalent of 4 or 5 cups of coffee a day was very protective with people that had breast cancer. But she also said, and Lynn maybe can clarify if I've missed the numbers, then I asked, well, there's some other studies that showed that there was a thing. I said, well, is it always at that 4 or 5 cups? She goes, no, it was a more reasonable level. Because you have a lot of downsides to taking 4 or 5 cups of coffee a day, obviously. It's very acidic. You know, you want to create an alkaline balance, especially when you're dealing with cancer. So you've got to be doing a lot of other things in that realm. And then caffeine has been shown in sub studies to help with insulin resistance and in other studies to hurt insulin resistance. So, again, you've got to see how people do. You know, it has to be organic, et cetera. So, you know, I'm one of these that's still not convinced that coffee has more good than bad. But I'd certainly rather see somebody drinking coffee than taking tamoxifen or some other kind of drug when they've got breast cancer or going for radiation if it can actually do that trick. So that's where I come from on that. And I think I need to do a little bit more research on the upsides. But I think it does have a lot of downsides. It's kind of like alcohol. People say, yeah, you know, the French drink all that wine and the wine is good for them. But, yeah, what's good for them in it? You know, it's the proanthanthins and some of the other antioxidants. How else can you get those without the downside of destroying your liver and your brain cells? And the thing with coffee, the tannins are very, very caustic. It can cause your gut to become inflamed. There's a lot of downsides to it. So I think I like to look at what's the research on things that are not addictive and don't have as much downside. So she she talked about turmeric. I mean, I love the idea of taking lots of turmeric and cordyceps mushroom and some of the other mushroom supplements she talked about as well. So, Bayari, I don't think you have another question. Yes. So there was a big, on my radio show yesterday, I had interviewed Christine Horner, and she really did talk about that sleep thing, and that's why I mentioned to Maria to go listen to it. You know, but she just really, she had some good points about the studies and the time and the reason, you know, the surge of melatonin that happens at midnight if you go to bed by 10, but it doesn't happen and it kind of peters out and you have a flat line. So even if you're sleeping, you may not be sleeping as deeply and feeling as rested. Interesting. Janet says, good morning. Where are you? You're on the West Coast, right? So it was morning when we started, I guess, or close to it. Ah, okay, Allison, I hope you're still hearing us. You said you were running from the iPad to the desktop, no internet. Uh-oh. So hopefully you'll be able to stay on. I find that on the iPad, sometimes the Instant Teleseminar and also some of the other services we do don't show well because they use Flash, but there's a browser that you can use called Puffin, and that's how I get on my iPad. Good. Let me see what's on the chat, and then I'll refer. Ah, see the chat. That's the thing about the chat. I said that earlier, like, oh, the chat sometimes dies, and it just did. So let me go back and see if it's just me or I'm refreshing it and see. There we go. I have to go put my name in. So hopefully you guys didn't get knocked out too. But if we can't really complain about it because they have it listed as a beta service, so it's use at your own risk. All right, let's see who's got stuff in here. Oh, Maria, you did post it. Thank you. I had recommended Maria when she sent it to me that she posted to Facebook. So thank you so much for doing that. Yeah, I loved how you did that. And you put the explanations in it, too. Heidi says, I've been walking the talk. I'm learning my still lingering emotional eats, which has forced me to dig deeper about my values. Thank you. I realize more now than ever before to do this reset that I want to enjoy all the aspects of my life, feel great doing these things, and teach others the same. The values part of this process is a huge part of the puzzle for me. Yay. Don't worry about the grammar, Heidi. My stuff is loaded with typos when I try to type fast into these little boxes, so we get the problem. Okay, so let's see. See what other questions came in. Florence, would someone with a methyl SNP mutation have a harder time controlling blood glucose? Liver not able to process the extra? You know, it certainly can. And the methylation issues, and there's so many of them. You know, when you say a methyl SNP, there's not a methyl SNP. You know, there's the MTHFRs. There's several of them. There's two main ones, but several minor ones. There's MTRRs and MTR, which is methyl transferase reductase and methyl transferase reductase, I forget the extra one, but they both, those two have to do with the B12 issues and the methylation of B12. Then there's BHMT SNPs, and there's receptor sites. There's so many different SNPs, and then there's all these cytochrome SNPs that can affect the liver as well, and then there's SNPs that actually affect blood sugar balancing. So the genetics can be a huge factor, but I don't think it's real clear, like, this SNP, this issue, right? And that's the thing with methylation and all the SNPs, and a lot of people, like, want that that allopathic approach, like, this means this, and it's so, like, there's so many variations. If you think about, like, 23andMe will measure, like, 700,000 SNPs. And if you think of all the possible permutations and combinations of those SNPs, holy cow, we're talking huge numbers that nobody can even fathom. And they interact with each other in different ways, and that's what makes us each unique, right? Even though we're 99.7 or whatever percent the same genetics, it's that 0.3% that's different. that makes us all variable. And so I think whenever we're looking at, and I didn't mention this a lot in the course, so I want to mention it now. Whenever we're looking at blood sugar imbalances, you can't forget to look at the liver because it has so much to do with keeping the blood sugars level, right? The glucagon, what does that do? It stimulates the liver to release its stored glycogen, stored sugar basically in the form of starch and glycogen in the liver. Well, if the liver is sluggish, it's not going to be able to do that as much. So when the glucagon can't be effective at bringing the sugar back up, like in the middle of the night or when we've had a long period of fasting, then it's going to create a stress response, which is going to trigger cortisol. You know, and cortisol will do its job and go break down some muscle tissue to increase the blood sugar via gluconeogenesis. But at what expense, right? Raising your heart rate, stiffening your arteries, increasing your blood pressure, closing down your digestion, closing down your higher level functioning, your prefrontal cortex, damaging your hippocampus. So the liver's big, and the liver's really it's a challenge. And I think some of the things that we should be teaching our people to do on a daily basis to support the liver is related to food and related to decreasing the toxic load. So, I mean, simple things like getting them to stop using commercial air fresheners and all the fluorocarbons and other things that they're breathing in, and to stop using plastic and all the various chemicals in the plastic that are affecting the liver, but also supporting the liver with wonderful things like turmeric. On the interview I did with Dr. Horner, she was a big fan of daily turmeric and said, you know, people don't want to eat curry every day, so get some tablets, capsules, right, 1,000 milligrams of turmeric a couple of times a day in capsule form for the days when you're not in the mood to eat curry again, right? I was just reading an article this morning that Dr. Greger, who puts out a daily, really nice daily health videos, you might want to check him out at nutritionfacts.org or nutritiondata.org. Let me look it up real quick. But he makes these really cool videos, and he does it every day, either a video or an email. And the guy is just, he's just a great researcher, and he just does this. And he, let's see, I saved it here earlier. I did save it here. Oh, here he is. And it's nutritionfacts.org. Yeah, nutritionfacts.org. And it's this one. It's why pepper boosts turmeric blood levels. So turmeric helps to support the liver and detox, as well as it's anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory, great for injuries, great for healing the gut. I mean, turmeric is like one of these, it's like too good to be true type of things. You know, I keep hearing that one of these days we're going to find out that there's something that's wrong in it. But there's thousands of studies that support turmeric. Well, he's finding that a little bit of black pepper, like a 16th of a teaspoon of black pepper mixed in with the turmeric, will actually accelerate the raising of the blood levels of turmeric even more. So turmeric for the liver, you know, daily or close to daily support that way. Dandelion, the dandelion root tea, dandelion leaves are good support, especially the roots. Eating burdock. So getting people to do those really nice daily things to support the liver. And then you can periodically have them do a more intense liver cleanse and start adding, you know, things like milk thistle. Although things like milk thistle are great. It's an antioxidant for the liver. That can help. Berberine. Berberine supports the liver. It also supports the gut. It also helps to bring the sugars down. And we think that the mechanisms are how that all ties together. So really educate yourself about all the ways that you can feed and nourish the liver to do its job and take the load off the liver is going to help a lot. And whenever somebody has these methylation SNPs, we have to go back to that person has to be even more rigorous about the clean diet and lifestyle. I remember back in my 20s when I got introduced to all this health stuff because I was ill and wasn't doing well, and I looked around in my family and I thought, wow, there's a lot of obesity, there's a lot of heart disease, there's a lot of diabetes, and there's no old people. And it was like, I must have pretty crappy genes. I mean, that was my thought. So I thought, well, if I have really bad genes, I have to do my very, very best to support my body and be really clean and pristine. Whereas, you know, George Burns might have had great genes so that he could drink and smoke and do all this stuff and live to be 100. Imagine, you know, the guy would still be kicking and going if he did the good stuff that we know to do. So I assumed that I had the bad stuff, and I just did it. And that was long before the Genome Project. Maybe not long before. It was probably about 6 or 7 years before the Genome Project actually started, where we actually started being able to look at it. And over the last 2 years, I started about 5 years ago to look at nutrigenomics and genetics. And it's a, you know, it's a slowly building process, and it's an expanding arena. But I was talking about it back in 2010 with the little knowledge that I had about it. Now I have a whole lot more, but there's so much more to learn. And what I found was when I actually did do my genetics, found out that I was right. I look at my genetics and I look at the genetics of some people who have bad habits but better genes than I, and I see that that's where I would be, given, you know, the double MTHFRs, the MTRRs, some of the COMTs, and some of, for those of you who know genetics, for those of you who don't, this is Greek. We do have a whole module, like lots and lots of resources that we'll be doing in NEPT down the road after we go through the core stuff to really pull it all together genetically. And I'm learning so much more. I just got access to all the videos from a recent methylation seminar that I'm going to be looking at. No, actually, not the videos. I got the slides and the transcripts. So I'm going to be looking at that. So I'm constantly learning to expand this. So for those of you in NEPT, that's, you know, hang tight. We'll go through it. But yeah, so somebody with a methylation SNP, sure, I think it would be. I think that depends on what their methylation and what their SNPs are. And anybody with impaired detoxification is definitely going to have an issue. Does that mean that they're stuck? No. What it means is they just need to do more to support their liver. And one of the things that can be helpful, just as a kind of maintenance routine thing for supporting the liver, is, you know, find some companies that you like that have some nice liver formulas, and then just have people go through one bottle this month and a different one the next month and a different one the next month. That way they're just like just feeding their liver, and they're going through the different formulas. They may find that on one of them they feel so much better, right? Their blood sugar stays better. They feel clearer. When they go back to a different one, they don't feel as good. And you may be able to find for that person, wow, that formula does wonders for them. And you have them do it. So a long-winded answer to a quick question, but anything related to methylation is not a quick question. So let me go back. It looks like Allison says, this is great. Thank you, Dr. Rita Marie. Still can't access on the desktop or laptop, so can't join in with voice. Insulin resistance practitioner course has been eye-opening. Agree, Ray, its effects of staying up late and stress. Yes, we're all those us hard-hitter go-getter, you know. That's why we're here and that's what we're doing, so we're so dedicated. So to staying up late. But, Allison, you could go to Skype. If you go to your Skype and you put in the content join.conference, and you don't have to wait for the conference. You just say add to contacts. Like typically you have to wait for that contact to get back to you. You just have to do that, and then you call that ID through your Skype, so it doesn't cost you anything, and you'll be able to get in to the conference and ask questions. So go for it. So Allison says, interesting, this reminds me of a patient I had with diabetes who worked late night shifts as a nurse. Hemoglobin A1C high and symptomatic diabetes with osmotic symptoms of thirst, weight gain, etc. Then she retired from night shifts, and within 3 months, her blood sugar balancing was so greatly improved. Yay, this is great. And Bayari is sympathizing, you know, or empathizing with Cassandra because she also works late. And then you don't know what to eat and when to eat to keep yourself going. And then when you're back on the regular shift, that's one of the most challenging situations you have. And when whether it's yourself or you're working with your clients and patients on this, that night shift stuff is very stressful on the body, and it's like really working with them and trial and erroring it to find out when it works to have them eat and move and do all that, and then to shift back to the other schedule gets even worse because your circadian gets used to one thing for 3 or 4 days, and then it has to go to another, and it's hard to keep it balanced. I would certainly, Yeah, so Bayari, Cassandra Bayari says maybe she and I could chat somewhere. You could probably do a little chatting on Facebook and then arrange to have a real chat sometime on Skype or something if you both feel like you want to do that. So reach out on the Facebook group. The Facebook group's been awesome. I'm just like in awe. You know, last night, I'm getting teary again when I think about it, I was reading some comments back and forth to each other, and it just brought tears to my eyes to see how supportive you are of each other and how you're helping. And we have that going on our grand Facebook group as well with people that are going through, and they're just so supportive of each other and offering, oh, yeah, just call me anytime and I'll help you with that. And this is what I've always dreamed about creating, is this community where we're all in it together. There's no competition. There is no, you know, one-upmanship. It's all like, how can I help you? And how can you help me, and how can we help each other so that we can help the world? So thank you all for being here. It's an emotional thing for me. So that was that. Yeah, so Florence is, how long can we stay on less than 50 grams of carbohydrate? That's a good question. You know, that would be considered a ketogenic diet. For some people, they can go 50 to 100 and be on a ketogenic. I personally don't think it's a forever diet. I think you need to go up from there. And I think that if you eat the Before Be Gone program the way that I've laid it out with a lot of vegetables, you're not really going to be in a ketogenic state because there's so many vegetables. I actually did it myself. I calculated everything I was eating, and I was getting between 150 and 200 grams of carbohydrate, and that's with no fruit and no grains. That's just from the nuts, seeds, and vegetables. So, I think that in some cases, staying on that ketogenic state forever can be helpful because it controls seizures and it might control things of MS. But even if you read Dr. Wall's book where she talks about a ketogenic diet for MS, it's not really intended to be a forever diet. It's intended to be a therapeutic diet, and then we increase the carbohydrate to where they need it. So, yeah, I think it's important to have the carbohydrate in there, but it has to be the carbohydrates that aren't causing fluctuation. And the whole goal of the reset is to allow your body to get to the point where you can handle more of the carbohydrates and not raise your blood sugar, assuming you don't go back to the standard American diet of processed carbohydrates. So we should all be able to tolerate as much fruit as we want because that's, you know, it's a natural, normal food. But because we've gotten out of balance from our poor lifestyle, our poor eating, our lack of sleep, or stress, et cetera, then we're not able to. But we all should be able to eat as much fruit as we want to, as long as we're balancing it with lots and lots of the greens for the minerals and all. That should be if we're all in balance. So the goal is to get us back in balance so that we can eat as many of them as we want, assuming they're whole, fresh, organic, and preferably raw carbohydrates. So Heidi says she's doing great, following the nutrition to a T, implementing heart math, bursts, and sleep, but not 100%. My blood sugars are already leveling, and this is exciting. I didn't realize how much of a problem I'm having with blood sugar. Tracking my results, food, sleep, etc., on the graph chart that my husband created and sharing it with a client that's walked through the process with me. I'm turn that off. My client is focused on the food and bursts and taking 1 week at a time. That's perfect. I began working with her 1 month prior to the reset, and she's now finally sleeping at night. Yay! She was struggling with that for years. Super. I'm using my daily results and sharing this with the client and a few others as an educational PC and hopefully motivating too. I'm also uploading pictures of many things I'm eating. Love to send the link to you. I would love to see it. Please do. And you can share it on the Facebook group. That would be very excellent because everybody would love to see that. So share it on the Facebook group if you're open to doing that. And this is great. You know that in the Before Be Gone, we do have a graph where you can actually let people see their glucose chart. And it's in one of the it's on the glucose page, and it's a Excel sheet. And the first one is just your standard, you know, tracking thing that they can print off and do on paper or do in the thing. But the other one is a shorter one where you just can track the food, what time you did it, what your sugar went up to, what the food was, and it'll graph it. My husband did that one for me. It'll graph it so you can see, oh, that person has a real big spike, and then they drop real low. You can actually see it visually. And we give you, like, a separate file for, like, 7 days of that. You can always copy-paste to make more. So I'd highly recommend you look at that. And if you're willing to share what your husband put together, share it on the Facebook page. If you're willing to share, I know a lot of this stuff takes a lot of work, and we're not all wanting to just give away the work that we do. So Bayari says she's working her shift. She'll listen in between customers ringing her. Good. I'm glad you're able to do that. I gave one of my colleagues a link to your radio show, and she listened, guessing she might ask me about the coffee. Okay, good. Let me see if anybody else has any. Let's refresh it. Hi, Ari. Question, do we consider black pepper an irritant? I've heard different things. I'm sure it's mixed with turmeric. It's fine. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that says black pepper can be an irritant, but also the pepperine in it, that you know, every one of these foods that has therapeutic value has these alkaloids and these volatile chemicals in them. And the one in turmeric is curcumin, and the one in pepper is pepperine, I think. And basically, it can be an irritant in high amounts, but we're really talking like a 1/16 of a teaspoon with a big old bunch of turmeric, and the studies seem to show that it can be very effective. But if somebody already has gastritis, then certainly the black pepper can be an irritant. So Florence said many of her clients have tested 23andMe, and many of them have the methyl slips, yes, more than MTHFR. I have MTHFR along with the one for blood sugar regulation. I don't do well with any carbohydrates, right? So that's why I asked the question regarding organs and damage, which you may or may not have gotten by the time you read this. Okay, yeah. So I think you just have to play it by ear and see, you know, when you say you don't do well with carbohydrates, I would stay on the reset for a month or 2 months and then just gradually increase it. So when you say you don't do well with carbohydrates, are you talking also like broccoli and cauliflower, cabbage, and the green leafy vegetables, because that's where I would be moving your carbohydrate intake up. If you're truly doing 50 or below, you're in a ketogenic state, and there's going to be some healing that will happen, especially in the nervous system, but then what you do is just gradually increase it and watch the results. So if you're not able to eat more than 50 grams of carbohydrate a day, it means you're not eating a whole lot of vegetables. So you would gradually increase the non-starchy vegetables to get you to the point where you're having more to get you out of that ketogenic state. But it's been shown that people can stay in that for a couple of years when they're doing it for therapeutic purposes. There's a number of books out there. Where's my iPad? I have one on my iPad from a doctor that spoke. If you go to Mercola.com and you type in ketogenic diet, there's actually an MD out there. I can't remember his name. But he wrote a book on ketogenic diets for cancer. And then you can also check Dr. Terry Wall's book to see if she addresses that issue as well. Okay, so I'm going to... Florence says, I eat a lot of seeds and nuts. Some cook carrots and beets. More raw usually. So if all the nuts have carbs in them, then I won't be concerned. Yeah, absolutely. If I were you, I would take your daily intake and go to fitday.com or one of those things that calculates, or do it by hand, and you'll be surprised. You probably, if you're eating any carrots and beets at all, you're probably getting about 50 grams of carbohydrate a day, especially with the nuts and seeds. So I would add it all up. When I did it, like I said, I went through 3 days. I didn't eat any fruits, any grains, and I ate, you know, just lots of soups and smoothies and veggies, and I was between 150 and 200. Only eat rice less than a quarter cup, maybe two times a month. I doubt you're in that ketogenic state then. Still spiking your blood sugar. So Florence, if it's spiking your blood sugar over 120, stay away from it. You may have to do 30 days, 60 days, but stay off of it, completely off of it, until you get it down. Do all the supplements, you know, all the other pieces, and then just play little by little, bring it up. Instead of doing a quarter cup, just this day a teaspoon or a tablespoon with your big salad. If that works, then the next time do 2 teaspoons or tablespoons with your big salad and veggie meal. And just gradually find your tolerance level. Yeah, that's what I would do. And the beets and carrots cooked, they're going to raise it. I mean, it sounds like you're sensitive and they're probably going to raise it. I eat all veggies, no yams or potatoes. I just don't eat many cooked carrots or beets. Rest of, you're probably not, there's no way you're keeping below 50 grams a day if you're eating enough calories. There's no way. I mean, the way people get below 50 grams a day is either just lots of veggies with a decent amount of fat for, and they're eating low calories. So they're eating below their normal calories, like 1,200 calories a day, 800 calories a day. And also, if you're eating just a minimum amount of veggies with a lot of meat, that's the way people get into ketogenic diets, unfortunately. But you may check out Dr. Wall's book, because she has, you know, she has the variation on the ketogenic diet that has a lot of vegetables. So, yeah, I doubt you're going below 50. I really do. All right. So, who else? Anybody else have a question? Comments? Raise your hand. Star 2. Of course, Eleanor. Eleanor and Tony. If Eleanor and Tony don't ask questions on a call, it's like shocking. Okay. Eleanor, go for it.
Hi. Hi. Wait, I have to stop laughing. I want to understand, you know, if you have diabetes and you're around 84 years old, are, you know, problems with temperature, like feeling cold or even sometimes feeling hot, but always seem to have different feelings about temperature than the people around you, or always being hungry a lot but still being skinny. Are those due to the diabetes, or is there something else going on?
Well, do they have they been diagnosed with type 1 or type 2?
Type 2 diabetes, and they're on medication.
And they're not on insulin.
Oh, they're on medication. No, not on insulin. Yeah.
They're not on insulin. You know, I would certainly test their insulin levels, because they may be going, you know, going into from the insulin resistance to the pancreas is no longer keeping up. And that would be, you know, the skinny and the thirst and that sort of test, temperature dysregulation. I would also look at, is it related to their thyroid or adrenal? So what's their thyroid function look like? Because that cold can be related to the thyroid being out of whack.
Okay, that is what I asked them to do, to get the thyroid test. But it could also be that the insulin, the pancreas is just not keeping up anymore.
Yeah, it could be. So get a fasting insulin. If the fasting insulin looks low, that could be good. If the fasting insulin is 3, we want to strive for that. But then you want to do a postprandial insulin, which you do probably about 45 minutes after eating. And if it's still 3, you know, they're not doing it. And then you want to make sure that they don't also have an autoimmune process going on. So if they get the postprandial and it's low, you want to know why. Is it that the pancreas is burned out from all these years of having type 2 diabetes and creating a lot of insulin? Because that's what people do in type 2 diabetes. You create too much, and then the pancreatic islet cells get burned out after a while. But the other issue might be that it's autoimmune, that they've developed an autoimmune condition. And you can test like islet cell antibodies and anti-insulin antibodies. So it's a staged approach. You don't just jump in and test those things because they're expensive, but you look to see how's their insulin doing. I remember reading an article by a doctor who was saying this cute lady was quite up in age, and she was eating all this stuff, and she had all these signs of insulin resistance. She had high hemoglobin A1C, but the point was her blood sugars were fine. And he couldn't understand it. So he took her insulin levels, and her insulin was going up to like 90 after meals, which is horrendously high. So she was producing so much insulin that it cleared the blood, so she never showed high blood sugar for any length of time, not long enough to catch it. But she was overproducing insulin, so she was type 2 diabetic. But he basically wrote in the article, like, this woman had this pancreas of steel, that her pancreas at, you know, her age, she was high up there, was just continued to be able to produce insulin, whereas most people, they're overproducing the insulin for enough years that after a while the pancreas gets burned out, and then they show signs of type 1, which means that they're not producing enough, and oftentimes they're put on insulin at that point.
Okay.
Okay, so it's just like all the stuff we've learned to date. Make sure her digestion is okay, too, because that's going to be contributing, right? If she's got a parasite or some kind of gut bug going on, if she's got leaky gut, is she off of gluten and all the other allergens?
Yeah, I just didn't know where to start with this one. My gut was to start with the thyroid to just get it tested to see what was going on, but I was just
you could, but also look at her gut. Like when we're looking at this, that's why I present a functional hierarchy. She's got the blood sugar stuff. Is there something lower in the hierarchy? Like, you know, her habits certainly and her immune system being overreactive from eating allergens, but also you want to look at her digestion, because the digestion can be feeding all the stress on the system.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
This is the thing when we're working with people, it may seem like, well, we're always starting with the same place. Aren't we doing unique? No, we are, but we're going to uniquely figure out where they're at. But if you jump in and try to fix the thyroid, but you haven't looked at the digestion, and the digestion is leading to the blood sugar imbalance, which is leading to the thyroid imbalance, which is leading to the symptoms that she's getting, then you've got to go far enough back. Make sense?
Right.
And
right,
the foundations always come from eating a good diet, getting the stress, getting the sleep. So all of those are kind of foundational things that regardless of how it's manifesting and where the imbalance is manifesting, if you don't fix those foundations, none of it's going to get fixed.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. It's just hard when to convince them to start talking about their gut when they, like, why are you talking to me about that? I don't have to digest.
Right. So there's ways to talk. That's a great point. So there's ways to do that. Excuse me. Let me grab some water. I'm out of water. Talking too much, and I don't have here. There's some water in there. Okay, so you start with, "Hey, Mary, I'm so excited to work with you, and I see that you have diabetes, and you're having this hot and cold stuff going on, and there's a lot of things that could be causing it. So let me ask you some questions." And you say to them, "You know, oftentimes doctors want to jump in and kind of give you something to solve your problem, and that's kind of an allopathic approach. That's Western medicine. Here's a drug to handle the problem, but it's not really looking at why you have this problem. So while I'd like to give you some things to look at, and maybe we can help you with, you know, the uncomfortable symptoms, if you really want to long-term solve this, we have to look backwards to see what's causing it. And what we find is a lot of times when the digestion is out of balance, it completely throws off the blood sugar, and we need to have the digestion working in order to have the right microbes in there and in order to not stress the levels of blood sugar and not stress the adrenal. So you can make that connection, you know, and I would practice making that connection from wherever they are. So we're going to just look backwards, and we're going to just look to see what might be causing it. And I don't want to just address a symptom, because that's not giving you the help that you really need. I want to be able to look at what's causing it so you can prevent this from happening. How does that sound? You know, and get their buy-in along the way.
Yeah, that's great.
Tell them why you're asking the questions about their digestion. And if they have not complained about diabetes or blood sugar, but they're complaining about hot flashes, yeah, if you say, well, how's your blood sugar? Oh, it's fine. That's not enough, right? So you explain to them that what we find is the reproductive hormones that cause the hot flashes and all this, they only get out of balance when there's something else that's causing it. They generally don't malfunction on their own, so we want to get at the root cause. So I'm going to ask you a lot of questions that may seem not to be related. So just bear with me. I have a method to my madness. And if you explain it right up front, you know, one of the things you always want to do is think about what are their objections going to be and address it right up front. Right up front. Make sense?
Yes, 100%. Yes.
Cool.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. Right,
we have time for one more question, and then we're going on to my next call. I have to get my water filled up before that, or I'll lose it. All right, Tony.
Hey, Dr. Marie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, thank you. I didn't want to throw off your rhythm of the day by not asking a question or making a comment.
I would be disappointed if you didn't.
Yeah. Well, it'll be very quick, I promise. So last week, I don't know which call was on, but I talked about a young man who approached me, type 1 diabetic, and he gave me a little bit more information. It's autoimmune related, and he's had since 12, and he's 40 years old now. And he does do the insulin pump. And based on the conversations that we've been having with, people with blood sugar issues and everything going back to the gut, if we work with his gut, is there a potential for him to reduce his reliance on the insulin?
I've seen it happen. First of all, like getting him, he may already know how to eat right, but if he's been going by the American Dietetics Exchange Program, not exactly eating right, so you help him with that. You get rid of the allergens. You do all the things that are going to help to support the gut and the immune system, right? It's autoimmune, so we have to look at inflammation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So things like getting him to add some of the foods and take some nutrients or antioxidants and things that are going to support his immune system. But I've seen it happen. I worked with somebody who was on a pump, and she got down to, like, she would monitor it, and it was just like, oh, my God, I only took this much today, and usually I was taking four times that amount. So it just,
right.
As she changed her diet, will they get off of it completely? You know, depending on how much damage has been done, likely not if it's been, 38 years or 28
mm-hmm.
years or however long he's been on it.
Yeah.
Right, that's a long time, and there could be a lot of damage. But assuming it was 16 and he started at 12, you might be able to get him off completely. Maybe not. It just depends on the damage and how well you can get the levels up. You have to be able to help him to be able to make enough insulin.
Well, here's the good news. He wants to convert to vegetarian. That's the reason he came to me. He wanted me to help him because he knows that I'm a Roku chef and I've helped people transition. And then he said, oh, by the way, I'm type 1 diabetic. I'm like, well, we need to address that too, But,
yeah, and sometimes just addressing it with the going to a high vegetable, whole foods, low glycemic raw foods diet can do a tremendous amount. And then if you always also look at the gut issues and
mm-hmm.
and any other issues that might be contributing, adrenals and things like that, then it could be. I've seen it reduce, like I said, maybe not completely, but certainly can reduce.
Right. Well, I'm excited to work with him. He said he tried 8 years ago to do vegetarian plant-based diet, and he did see his reliance on insulin go down, but he just had difficulty maintaining good health. He tried it for 2 years. So he's excited to work with me to help him.
Yeah,
because
you can help him do it in a balanced way.
Absolutely, that is the plan.
That's the plan, and then you know enough about these other things. So focus on what he came to you for, which is clean up his diet first. He's already said that, right? You don't have to do the stealth diet approach that a lot of people, you have to go, well, in order to get this problem solved, I have to get this. He's come and said, help me fix my diet. So start there and then say, yes, there's some other things that we can also address. With the diet, here's a few things that maybe we can clean up your gut, which is going to help you absorb all these nutrients better, which may be why you didn't have a good results last time, because you weren't addressing the absorption issues and whatnot.
Great. Thank you so much, as always. And I want to just say thank you to everyone else, particularly Maria. I learned so much from her discussion, and I'm just overwhelmed with emotion because of all the wonderful sharing and the good information. So thank you all so much.
You're very welcome. So you're all welcome to stay on for the next call, which is our Vibrant Living members' monthly office hours, and we're going to be focusing on digestion. So we've spent a lot of time saying digestion is important. So we're going to be talking about digestion. I see some of the people filtering in. So those of you who are filtering in, I see who do I see? Jackie. I'm looking to see. Oh, so far just Jackie. Who else do I see coming in? Jackie. Anyway, whoever comes in. So you guys are all welcome, you IRSPT people, because as we've said, digestion is so important, and you're welcome to stay and listen in and ask questions if you have. So thank you, Tony. And you're right. You've got to ask questions every time, or I would be really bummed.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So So I'm going to stop the recording for IRSP